So, good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy. It's the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and of the hosts, and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. In today's program, we will discuss milestones and the latest news in the community rights movement and their implications in the current political climate, based much on a book published last year titled We the People, Stories from the Community Rights Movement in the United States. Our guest is one of the book's co-authors, Thomas Lindsay, who is the executive director and chief legal counsel of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. That's CELDEF, C-E-L-D-F. Which he co-founded in 1995. CELDEF is a nonprofit public interest law firm that provides free and affordable legal services, education, and organizing assistance to residents and communities, organizations, and local governments across the U.S. and even to nation states around the world that face threats to their local environment and their agriculture, their economy, and their quality of life. CELDEF also sponsors democracy schools, from which more than 3,000 citizens have graduated, including several here in the county. So let's look at some milestones and the latest news from the community rights movement and their implications in the current political climate. Thomas Lindsay, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to have you here on our Pledge Drive show. Let me just give out the number, 895-2233, and we're going to get right into it. You've written a book that's gotten an enormous amount of praise from people who really count. I think Tom Hartman said, every community fighting a corporate Goliath should take these lessons to heart. So we might start out with what's wrong with the way people have traditionally tried to fight problems, environmental threats to their community.
Sure. So, just to bring all this down really to the most practical level, we get calls every day from folks in communities across the United States who are facing unwanted corporate projects coming into their communities. So for a long time, some of those calls that were coming in were about these huge factory farms, and now the hot topic of the last couple of years has been fracking. So, let's assume a frack well is coming in next to you. Company has announced plans to put a frack well, one of these hydrofracking for natural gas wells, in next to your house. Where do you turn if you have questions, don't want it, want to stop those types of things from coming into the community? All this is usually pretty new to people who are first-time activists, first-time involved in this type of thing. And so they usually turn to the state environmental agency that they have and begin asking questions about things called permits. So for a frack well to go in next door, you need a permit from the state environmental agency. And that permit is generally issued under a set of rules, which are known as environmental regulations. And unfortunately, as most of us know already, but it's a nasty little fact that most of the regulations are written not by the people who are affected by these projects coming into their communities, but most of the regulatory schemes, the regulatory structure is written by the corporations that operate underneath them. So you have the agribusiness corporations writing agricultural and factory farm regulations. You have energy corporations writing energy regulations. And it should come as no surprise that when you have that frack well being dropped next to your house in your community, that those environmental regulations that you would normally turn to for help don't have much in them that can help you, because they're written generally by the entities that are benefiting from putting those facilities into your community in the first place. So it's almost like, when you find out that the frack well is going in, that it's the eighth inning of a nine-inning game, and the corporation putting the frack well in has gotten everything they need to legally operate the well, you're on the defensive at that point, and it's hard to know where to turn. So some folks turn to the environmental agencies. They ask questions about getting involved in the permit process, but getting involved in the permit process itself, of course, is a dead end, because you're operating under rules that somebody else wrote, which essentially makes your position predictable in terms of how you fight these things coming in through the permit regulatory system. And others actually call the corporation up and ask questions and advice, and the corporation, of course, sends them right back into the permit and regulatory system. Others call environmental groups who have been dedicated to stopping these types of facilities from coming in. They'll call the environmental organization. Generally, the environmental group will steer them right back into the permit and regulatory process as well, because for the past 40 years, that's what environmental organizations have done in the United States, which is tried to work within those permit and regulatory structures. So the basic question you ask is, what's wrong with the way people have been fighting these types of projects over the last 40 years? And the simple answer to that is we've lost, and we have a losing record. And that losing record is predetermined. That has been, you know, you can't expect to fight under rules that have been written by someone else and expect to win. And that's why we're in the dire straits that we're in, which is that for the past 40 years, our environmental activism within that permit and regulatory system has been almost completely ineffective. Certainly ineffective at stopping individual projects, even more ineffective at giving birth to the shift that has to take place to a different kind of economy and a different kind of legal structure and a different kind of paradigm. So, you know, either we take our heads out of our butts and understand that the system that's been delivered to us is not the system that's going to allow us to change things where they need to be, or we continue to do the same thing over and over and over again and expect a different result. And that process of expecting a different result and doing the same thing over and over again is called insanity, because we're never going to get a different result. It's been predetermined for us to get the result that we've been getting, so that's where we're stuck.
There's so many ways they have around it. They can just pay the fines and have that be a cost of doing business. They can make one little change and then it's the permit is then in compliance. They have like a million little tricks.
Yeah, and it gets even worse, as we learned in the 10 years that we were doing permit regulatory stuff and enforcing conventional environmental laws, which is for the communities, they have to carry the costs for the lawyers and go through the permit appeal process and all that kind of stuff. For the corporations, though, the permittees, when they spend money on the lawyers and the permit defense process, it's all tax deductible under the tax code as a reasonable and necessary business expense. So, for 10 years, we figured at least we were costing the corporations money when we would go in to appeal a permit that was issued by one of the state agencies. But in reality, it's all a tax write-off for the company, because it's seen as a reasonable and necessary business expense in the operation of the corporation.
And what our local people have found a lot, and they're incredulous every time it happens, is that you're not allowed to say no. If the zoning is a certain way and some big corporate big box wants to plunk down in the middle of your historic small town, downtown area, it might be against the law to say no.
Yeah, and that's like the nasty little secret of the legal system, that I would say 99% of the folks out there who have never tangled with the permit regulatory system or the system of laws behind it think that communities actually have some degree of self-governance, that people within a city or a town or a village or a county could actually ban big box stores or ban corporate factory farms or ban fracking. And the problem is they can't. And they can't not only because of the way the permit stuff is written by the companies which allow them to come in, but because of a system of laws developed in this country over the past 150 years, that corporations, who are the main benefactor of that system of law, have essentially engineered or concocted or manufactured a system of law that prohibits communities from banning these uses. So, in a very practical sense, if you're in a community that wants to ban oil and gas extraction within the community, and you attempt to do so, so you use your lawmaking process at the city or town level to pass a ban on oil and gas extraction within your particular municipality, the first thing that happens is you get sued. And you get sued by the corporation that's affected by that local law that you've then passed. And that corporation comes at you certain ways. So for 20 years we've been doing this work, we've almost come to a point where we can blueprint out exactly how the challenge is going to come in from the corporation. And primarily they use these three legal doctrines, which always sound legalese, but affect us every day when we get these projects coming into our communities. One is preemption, where the state government has the legal authority to override local lawmaking. So most states have oil and gas acts, which actually nullify local laws that ban oil and gas extraction in that particular issue area. Then you have something called corporate rights, which, of course, I don't need to explain to your listeners probably, but corporations have certain constitutional rights in the United States that protect their property, the corporate property, and can use those to nullify local lawmaking when that local lawmaking interferes with the corporation's property. And the permit itself is issued to the corporation, and most people don't understand this either, but the permit itself is property. It's owned. So the permit can be bought and sold. It has value. It's actually property that's interfered with by the municipality when they pass one of those laws. And the final doctrine is this thing called Dillon's Rule, which is a holdover from the 1790s, mostly the 1800s, when the Supreme Court adopted this law. But it says that your municipality's lawmaking scope, in other words, what you can and can't pass, you can't pass anything at the local level unless the state government specifically authorizes you to do so. So if you attempt to pass an oil and gas extraction ban and the state hasn't specifically authorized your municipality, your city, village, county, or town to actually pass something like that in that area, then you can't. It's automatically assumed that you can. So the corporation, when they come in, these three legal doctrines act as a box almost to keep us in a certain place within our municipality and away from being self-governing. So the corporate rights piece is privately enforceable, so the corporation sues your municipality for violating their corporate rights. The preemption stuff is also privately enforceable, so the corporation comes in and sues you for violating preemption law, saying you had no authority to pass the law that you did. And Dillon's Rule comes in the door because they say you had no authority to pass the law that you did because the state hasn't given you the authority to pass that. And so, you know, taken together, the machinery of how this system operates, which is rarely seen by average people, you know, rarely seen by people outside of the clerics, the lawyers and the judges and the people involved in the legal system, the people who do this full time. Most people have no idea how the system actually functions in that respect. If they did, we think that there would be a backlash against how that system functions and there would be changes to how it functions because in reality, and we've gotten a lot clearer about this over the last 20 years that we've done this work, we're not a free people. When you live under a system in which your community has been divested almost systematically of any authority to decide its future about what doesn't come in, what does come in, how the community works, we're not free. It's almost like our communities are enslaved because if a corporation has an idea about something they want to do, the community is in a subordinate position to the corporation and is almost, in many ways, enslaved to that system or proposal or project that the corporation wants to put into place. So we've become a lot clearer, I think, in this community rights movement concept that communities should have the right to say no and should have the right to define a sustainable economic and environmental future, that we are not free in that sense. We are not a free people. We are constrained and restricted by those doctrines, much in the same way that, you know, if the federal government decided to pass this three-sentence law that said communities don't have X, Y, and Z authority to govern themselves, the effect of those three doctrines and the private power and wealth of the corporations using them is the same as opening up a law book and seeing those, you know, three sentences that the federal government would pass, say, municipalities, you have no power to do X. So in many ways, we're not free, and I think that's one of the things that's beginning to galvanize people across the United States as they come face-to-face with this thing and begin to try to change it.
Yeah. This all reminds me of a couple of quotes, and there's a few I'd like to mention through the program, but one of them infamously is, I think, from you yourself, the only thing environmental regulation regulates is environmentalists.
That's priceless. Yeah, I like that.
And the other one related here is that you get – what you regulate, saying no is the rare exception to what is traditional law.
But our guest here, Thomas Lindsay, along with Annika Campbell, have put together kind of a localities guidebook for fighting off corporations that want to ruin their environment. It's called We the People, and it's kind of case studies in a new approach since the old one, as you said, you never win. A new approach where sometimes you do win. It's a lot of hard work, but it's a positive way forward. And I think we need that now more than ever, just like we need this station now more than ever. This is an outpost of free speech in a kind of a scary time. So I hope you'll support the station. 895-2233. Steve, you have some thank yous?
I have a few here. One is a new member challenge from someone in the community who used to be a programmer on the station. And so thank you for that challenge. And that is a matching challenge of $25 if someone would like to call in with that.
Thank you.
The second is an anonymous donor from the area. And a third one has come in from, this is cute, one of our friends in the Ukiah Scrabble Club. We play a couple times a month. And with a comment that to us that we're a vital part of KZYX and loves all the programming here.
I think that anonymous one was actually mine. I put in a few bucks on our show, but really not only for our show, to support all the shows on the station, like World Music and Beth and Liz and Lorena and the woman on the coast. Tell me her name. Alina. They do a fabulous job. There's all the jazz shows. I think some of our jazz shows are really wonderful. We have some geniuses that do the classical music, Susan Jewell and Patrick Gomes. Mm-hmm. We have a really cool station, and we have a community-based organization. You can lift up the phone and call the station and talk to a real person and get some real results. So please support this independent community resource, 895-2233. And so we're going to continue on now with, thank goodness we have Thomas Lindsley with us today to help us navigate this even worse situation that we're in now with an extremely corporocracy, I would say, extremely corporate-friendly administration. And so we're looking at this book you can get as a gift if you subscribe to the station. If you do a Bill of the Month Club, which is $120, but it's only $10 a month, you will qualify to receive a copy of We the People. And I'd like to read just one of many promos that this book has gotten. Randy Hayes of Rainforest Action Network says, "Nature's right to gloriously carry forth our as inalienable as the sun rising each morning, yet we must fight hard to codify those immutable principles in human law and community practice. Tom Lindsay and Annika Campbell's remarkable book helped to revolutionize our thinking and our plan to enact and sustain this deep common sense." So thank you so much, Thomas Lindsay, for writing that book and for being on the air with us today.
Sure, thanks for having us.
So now maybe we can get into, so what is this alternative approach that you've developed at your CellDef organization?
Well, before we get to that, the one thing that quote sparked in my mind is that we're really talking about two things here, which are united by some common principles. So we're talking about community self-determination, that communities in the United States, municipal communities, so place-based, so cities, villages, towns, counties, that people there have a right. What we argue is that they have a constitutional right to decide what happens in their own communities. And so it's a vested right that goes back to the very beginnings of the foundation of this country and beyond in some ways. So constitutional right to govern themselves as part of that self-determination. The other piece of it, which is connected to that, is this rights of nature concept, that for the last 10,000 years in, you know, Western civilized thought, that nature has always been property, something to be owned. And we don't really think too much about that nowadays outside of certain circles, but if you have a deed to a piece of property, that deed, as part of its bundle of rights, carries with it the right to destroy that property. And this is assuming that there's no endangered species or wetlands or something like that on the property. But because nature is property, the more you can own under the system of law, the more you can destroy. Because that deed, that ownership, comes with it the authority to destroy the ecosystems and nature that exist on that piece of property. That's black letter law, has been been that way for a long, long time. Fortunately for us, indigenous communities have always had a different vision of nature. And that different vision of nature is that nature is a being, that it's living systems, and it can't be owned by anyone, especially when that ownership carries with it the right to destroy those ecosystems that are dependent upon that property. And so picking up on that line of thought that nature is not property, nature is something else, white law professors back in the 1970s and slightly earlier began talking about this concept of rights of nature, that nature should possess certain rights that our ownership of nature can't override, that nature has a right to life, that ecosystems have a right to life, a right to thrive, that rivers have a right to flow, that certain ecosystems have rights consistent with those ecosystems themselves. And this understanding, this awareness that nature has been subordinated to property interests in Western civilization, especially within U.S. law, is also a galvanizing factor for people moving forward. Because, of course, you can't go to your state legislature and say, hey, boys, state reps, let's put the rights of nature and recognize that ecosystems have rights within the state. You're not going to get anywhere, and the federal government's even worse. So the only place you can move something like this is at the local level through this community government work that we've been doing. And the only way to do that is if you recognize this right of local community self-government, because the rights of nature, if they're to be created, have to be created and recognized by the same mechanisms that people are using for local self-government in their communities. So that's a long way around to saying we had to come after 12, 15 years, and we're still learning today, of course, about how the system functions. Not only does it function to elevate property and commerce above the rights of people, communities, and nature, but it also functions essentially to destroy, it's almost like a suicide pact, to destroy nature and ecosystems. And even when the regulatory system is working perfectly, all it's doing is regulating the rate at which we destroy nature and ecosystems. It's not stopping anything, it's just regulating the rate at which that happens. And so, 12 years ago, 13 or more than that now, 20 years ago, we came to a certain set of conclusions that environmental law was not working, that it was a guarantee of this continued destruction, but it had nothing to do with actually protecting the environment, that we've never had an environmental movement in the United States, because movements tend to shift stuff that's treated as things under the law into being persons under the law with rights. So the suffragists took women from being property under the law to being rights-bearing, still not in all respects, but at least some, including suffrage and some other rights. African Americans were once treated as property under the law. They were shifted into being people, rights-bearing people. And again, that hasn't—that's not in totality either. But some rights accrued to that process to shift them from being a thing to a person. And I think the same thing has to happen today, from being communities who are basically not treated as self-governing communities, and nature, which is not treated as having rights, that those have to be shifted into that other category of being rights-bearing rather than being things. And so we had to come to those conclusions ourselves over the years about what needed to happen. And then communities who are engaged in this bare-knuckle brawl with energy and agribusiness and pipeline and fracking corporations had to at least begin to understand that material enough to begin asserting those rights at the local level. And so was birthed the community rights movement. So the first community rights ordinance was passed in 2001. And those early ordinances essentially were the communities, not to be rough about it, but putting up their middle finger to the corporation and saying, we're not going to allow you in here. We're not going to allow you to set up shop. We're not going to allow you to put this project in. And in addition to that, we're going to challenge your basic authority to come in. We're gonna nullify your corporate rights. We're gonna say that we're gonna return to an original understanding of this country in which corporations didn't have certain rights. We're gonna recognize nature as having rights, so not as property, but having rights. And we're gonna nullify these other doctrines, Dillon's rule and preemption, the stuff that we've been talking about today. And we're gonna say that we have a constitutional right of local self-government here, and that overrides those other doctrines. That we are more powerful than the corporations that want to come in and use our community for extraction or for some other kind of exploitation. And so starting in 2001, finally coming around to the question, which is we began to work with communities across the United States to, number one, understand how the system functions before communities got dumped into the regulatory scheme. So before they got involved in hiring lawyers and going after permit conditions and doing all the stuff that environmental law has been about for the past 40 years, we tried to pull them out of that. And that's what we do today in some ways, is that there are smart people in communities across the United States who understand how this permit regulatory system works. They are beginning to reject it, and they have for the past 20 years in varying degrees in different places. Our job is to guide them through that process so that they have a full understanding of the system of law that they're operating in. And then with that full understanding of the system of law they're operating within, to actually dismantle that. And to hijack, we use the word seize, hijack, use, propel, their local government structure, their municipal government, to become what it wasn't supposed to become under the conventional law that we have today, which is a self-governing unit. It's actually people seizing those municipal structures and turning them into something that they were not, haven't been intended to be over the past 100 years. They're intended to be a state administrative unit. So our municipal governments are basically supposed to carry out state policy. That's, you know, at bedrock, that's what they're for under the existing system of law. Our job has been to help communities turn them upwards as guided missiles against the corporations and the government that enables those corporations to come in to put in certain projects in those communities. And since 2001, close to 200 communities across the United States, including major municipalities like the city of Pittsburgh, have actually drafted and adopted local laws, either through their local elected officials or through initiative processes or something called home rule charters, where communities actually write their own constitutions, to lead a revolt against the current system of law to fundamentally change it, with an understanding that if we don't fundamentally change the way that the law is structured, that we're all pretty much screwed. That unless we begin to change the DNA or the source code of how this country operates and what the country's default is in terms of the law, that we are going to be continue to be worse off every year than we were before. And with things like climate change, you know, these massive global destabilizing environmental issues that we've now created, that we either do it now or we don't do it at all. And I think when I wake up in the morning, at least, and, you know, for the past 20-some years we've been doing this work, my battery gets charged by communities, and specifically people, who have come to the same conclusions that we have and who have begun to do very, very courageous, frontline, bold work, which is to say this conventional system that we have, which has been contoured over the past 150 years to help certain interests but not others, needs to go. And the only way it's going to go is if we begin to commit civil disobedience through our municipalities to actually use our municipal units to put that new system of law in place, not waiting for others to say, hey, it's okay to do that, or waiting for the law professors to opine, yes, it's legal to do that, or for the judges to say, yes, it's constitutional to do that, but to ignore all of that and say, we know what's best for this community, and we know what's best for the global community in terms of stopping these global environmental challenges, and we're going to do it anyway. That's what it's going to take, is a tide of people who say, we don't care what the important people say, we don't care what the experts say, because those are the folks that got us here in the first place. We're going to build an entirely new system from scratch, and that system is going to be built around democracy. It's going to be built around corporate subordinacy to that, to those governments. It's going to be built around rights for nature, and it's going to be built around our authority to self-determine what our communities look like. Because otherwise, again, we're pretty much out of time.
Yeah. Well, this brings me to a few other quotes I'd like to mention from the book. Going back to 2002, I believe it's Licking Township, Pennsylvania. That was the first community in the U.S. to enact a local law stripping corporations of personhood rights. And that's explained in the book.
Yeah, let me mention this. The book has an index where you can find the actual ordinances written out in the charters and so forth. So it's a good appendix. Don't let that scare you. It's not a big book. It's a small, portable, easy-to-use guideline of case studies that can help you create safety and protection for your community, too. And you should call 895-2233 if you're interested in this, and I think we all should be right now. 895-2233.
And that's what will keep us on the air here with Corporations and Democracy. We've been running since the very late 80s. It's a little over 20 years here on the air. Andy and I have been on it for 8 years. And certainly look forward to continuing. So please pick up the phone, call 895-2233 to pledge today to keep us on the air and keep KZYX in good health here.
Here's what Yes Magazine says about We the People. It says, a healthier democracy starts right here. I like that. That's succinct, and that really is a little rule book for how to take back your democracy for your own locale. And then I think you're going to talk later about how locales link together, because that's important too. 895-2233. We've raised almost $300 so far. We need to collect a little more to make this station a green, a dynamic, healthy radio station out here in the middle of nowhere, but we have listeners all over the county. Another thing that this station does is it brings those different parts of the county together between Covelo and Hopland. All of that news, the mission of this station is to address the entire county. 895-2233 to get a copy of We the People. You can do that for a Bill of the Month Club, $10 a month, and that would help the station pay their bills. They like that kind of regularity of income, and so it makes the station bookkeeper smile when he gets a Bill of the Month Club.
Well, indeed it does. Or if a $120 pledge, one-time pledge, will get you the book. And there's some other items you can answers can tell you that there are premiums for the station. But most important, it keeps the station in good health and keeps us on the air. I wanted to mention a few other quotes here. This is 2006, the borough of Tamaqua, Pennsylvania. First community in the United States to recognize ecosystems and nature as having rights. And I believe Seldev was involved with that.
Yep, we helped the borough draft it, and the borough council persons were the ones that passed that ordinance.
Okay, and then you mentioned Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So it was just, 7 years ago now, November 2010, when the City Council of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, unanimously adopted a first-in-the-nation ordinance banning corporations from natural gas drilling in the city.
Go ahead.
The City of Pittsburgh also amazingly adopted rights of nature provisions in that ordinance. So you had a unanimous City Council recognizing that ecosystems like the Youghiogheny River as it travels through the City of Pittsburgh, the municipal boundaries actually, has the right to exist and flourish and thrive and all those good things.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you take this moment to talk a little bit about CELDEF. What does CELDEF stand for, and how do you get your money to operate, and how is it structured, and how do people find you and all that?
So the organization is the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and most people know it by the acronym because the name is so long, so CELDEF. We're located on the web at celdef.org, so that's C-E-L-D as in David, F as in Frank, .org. And we have a library of ordinances. We offer, you guys mentioned, Democracy School, which is a 3-day training that we run for lawyers and municipal officials and citizens, residents in these communities that are facing off against these types of things. And our history is that we started as a standard, conventional, public interest environmental law firm. So for 10 years, we litigated Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and National Environmental Policy Act cases and did tons of permit appeals and running through the state regulatory processes. And ironically, we were successful on, most of the permit appeals that we would file, because something like 90% of permits in the United States are never appealed, period, because the community groups don't have the resources to actually appeal those permits. So sometimes just by showing up, we would win, on the conventional permit appeal. But the problem is, as was mentioned earlier, that the corporation would just come back and they would come back with, you know, filling in the requirements that we had found that they had not satisfied the first time around. So I had lawyers from some of the largest corporations in the United States, you know, like Chemical Waste Management, coming up to me after these hearings thanking me for finding the gaps and omissions and deficiencies in the permit application that they had submitted.
Oh my
because
God.
Then the law firm could bill more money to the company to then fill in those gaps and omissions and then resubmit the permit application. So even though we would win those permit appeals, you know, sometimes there'd be 7 rounds or 8 rounds of that, and finally there'd be a completed application, at which point the community group would ask us to help them again, and we couldn't because there was no levers left within the existing environmental law stuff. So that those were some of our experiences. But today, yeah, we have a staff of about 20. So we have, you know, half of those are environmental lawyers and constitutional lawyers who defend our ordinances. So we offer free legal representation to municipalities if they adopt one of our ordinances. We offer our services as representation so that they can retain us to defend the local laws that they've adopted. And the other half are organizers. So we have community organizers in 5 states. And those folks work hand-in-hand with the lawyers and also are the primary point of contact for the municipal officials and residents in those communities that are fighting specific things. In terms of funding, we have a full-time grant writer. So, you know, foundations provide about half of our support. So organized institutional giving. And then the other half comes in from small donations, $20, $50, $100 from folks. We have a newsletter. We try to integrate people that give us small donations into the day-to-day of what's happening with the Legal Defense Fund and the communities that we're helping. At any given time, we're probably assisting about 100 communities across the United States, and we have focused work in 10 of those states.
Okay, I'm going to give out the number again, 895-2233, just so that our phone answerers don't fall asleep out there. We have some cool people out there waiting to talk to you. So this is really a wonderful new direction, a rights-based approach to bring to the campaign. About how about the stuff that's coming down on us now, not just the local communities fighting off fracking and so forth and drilling and pollution of all kinds of corporate degrees. How about climate change itself?
It's huge, and it's parts of it are unstoppable because we're already in the situation that we're in. But you know what we're working on today, and what's been included in some of our local laws, is something called a right to climate. That people have a right to a climate that's unaffected by fossil fuel emissions, and that nature itself, in other words, the climate itself or the atmosphere of the Earth, has certain rights. And so we've been working on those climate issues for a while. The most recent news is that Spokane, Washington, which is where I'm located now, is there's been a new initiative filed to actually stop the rail trains that are carrying coal and oil fossil fuels through the city of Spokane to the West Coast for shipment off the West Coast. There's now been an initiative here in the city filed that essentially says that the rail transportation of coal and oil through the city of Spokane is a violation of the people's rights to climate. And trying to leverage that as a rights-based approach to climate issues. And unbeknownst to most people, an Oregon federal court back in November actually ruled that a right to climate exists, that a constitutional right to climate exists.
There's a milestone.
Yay. Whoa.
So there's a federal judge who's actually held that a right to climate is on the same level as a right to privacy or due process or equal protection rights within the U.S. Constitution. That is a fundamental right. And so I think that gives a little bit of purchase to some of the work that we've been doing on right to climate issues. For a while, we were special counsel to the Maldives, the Maldive Islands, who were looking at a right to climate in their national constitution. We serve as special counsel now to folks in Nepal who are working to put a right to climate into the Nepalese constitution. And so I think the climate issues, people are slowly giving up hope that there's some kind of international agreement. You know, the Paris Agreement, even if it's enforced to its letter, it does not get us out of the degree rise that we need to actually stop significant amounts of warming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think international agreement process that they're turning more and more to local and things closer to home, and especially as a way to stop things like pipelines and frack wells and, you know, all the other stuff that comes as part of that energy infrastructure.
Right. Thank you for being in that slot right now when we need you. We want to thank our listeners. We also want to thank our underwriter. Support comes from our members and Mendocino Solar Service. For those who own or are planning to purchase an electric car, Mendocino Solar Service can provide information on home charging, including systems to produce and store solar energy during the day, allowing overnight charging from the day's production. More information at MendocinoSolar.com or 937-1701, and it's license number 536983. So thank you to our underwriters, and we also want to thank some members, right?
A couple of thank yous. One is from Carrie, and says thank you to Steve and Annie and to Tom, our guest today. And the second one is from Tom Wodetsky here in the county. Thank you very much, Tom. He says he loves this show and local news and the BBC. And let me remind listeners, then, that you're listening to Corporations and Democracy. Our topic today is the latest news from the community rights movement and its implications in the current political climate, based much upon the book published last year called We the People, Stories from the Community Rights Movement in the United States. And we're talking with Thomas Lindsay. He's the executive director and co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, and co-author of the new book. And CELDEF is at celdef.org. That's CELDEF.org. And the book is one of the premiums for pledges during the program today. So you can call it 895-2233 to make a pledge to the station and consider the book or numerous other premiums that are available for pledges.
Here's something that somebody said about We the People, which is Steve just referred to. You can get for a Bill of the Month Club or a donation of $120. Here's what Kenny Ossibel said. He's the founder of the Bioneers. This powerful book is a field guide to nonviolent revolution. It tells the story of how courageous communities are using innovative legal and political strategies to restore nature, communities, and democracy. It is some of the most important work in the world today. Read it and act. That's from Kenny Ossibel about this book, We the People, which you can get right here by calling 707-895-2233.
And a question to our guest, Tom. There were a couple of items headed for the ballot in November, having mentioned November a few minutes ago. Is there any update, new information about those? One was, Broadview Heights, Ohio, had passed an ordinance that was tossed by the courts, and then they were going to put that on the ballot directly, I believe, and it was headed for the ballot, but that's a year or so ago. So is there any update you have on what happened there?
Yeah, there's a real frontline fight happening in Ohio right now, which is several communities. Youngstown, Ohio, Broadview Heights, Mansfield, a bunch of different places have placed initiatives on the ballot. Some have gone through and passed, others have not. But the big frontline battle over the last 2 years has been moving forward new county charters. So people within Ohio counties have begun moving forward new structures of government, basically new local constitutions for their counties. And it looks like this year you're going to have probably somewhere between 5 to 8 counties moving forward with those proposals. But in the last two election cycles, the Secretary of State has intervened to actually take them off the ballot. So what the corporate boys have started to do is amp up the front end, trying to keep these initiatives even from the ballot so they don't get a vote. And in Ohio, the first time he pulled it, we took him up to the Ohio Supreme Court, and we won a partial ruling that said he couldn't exercise any constitutional review over these things before putting them on the ballot, but held that there was a procedural defect that made us put it on the next one. So put it on the next one, these counties ran it again. Secretary of State intervened again. This time the Ohio Supreme Court agreed with him on certain facets of his argument. And now we're into the third round, which is counties in Ohio, people in those counties are now beginning to qualify a new round of initiatives based on those county charters. And, of course, the whole reason to do the county charters is to ban oil and gas extraction within those counties, which mm-hmm. is the main thing driving stuff, is to get rid of oil and gas extraction in those counties. Mm-hmm. So the most active places right now are Ohio in terms of those counties. I mean, that's like a fifth of the counties of Ohio, so it's a big deal. In Pennsylvania, we have two local communities that are stopping frack wastewater injection wells from coming in. Believe it or not, the state agency, recognizing those local laws, actually stopped their review at the state level of a permit requested by the corporation to put those projects in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first time that the local lawmaking has actually influenced the state review of permits, which okay. is a pretty big deal. In the
big deal, yeah.
In Colorado, we have a town that's seeking to ban oil and gas extraction on the basis of a right to climate and also to legalize civil disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're seeing now is ordinances moving forward in which the police are being banned from arresting people who are engaged in civil disobedience to stop the oil and gas extraction from happening. So it's basically mm-hmm. decriminalizing certain civil disobedience or direct action once these ordinances are passed. So I think that's another exciting area. And then other places that are active or highly active, Oregon, a bunch of stuff happening in Oregon. And then, of course, we have these state-level groups which have now formed in five states, these community rights networks, which are putting forward state constitutional amendments to actually begin to change how the state constitution treats those municipalities within those states.
That's wonderful. We're making some breakthroughs here with a rights-based approach. But, of course, it's not easy. You're letting us know. I mean, we've had that happen here. We win one and lose one. We had a rights-based ordinance passed countywide against fracking, basically, as a right to nature ordinance. And that passed overwhelmingly. But then we had a home rule charter proposition that failed miserably. I think people were unclear exactly about what it would do and what it would not do. So people can find all kinds of tips for how to do it right through this book, We the People. And I encourage you to phone 895-2233 so you have that information at your fingertips and it can help you in the upcoming tough months we have to look at.
I'll put a plug in here for the Measure S crew that worked on that campaign. That was in November of 2014. And, Tom, if you didn't know, it passed here. This was an anti-fracking and community rights measure passed by 69.52%. That rounds to a nice even 70.
Hey. So one of the things that's a delight in your book is we learn the stories of people within the community who rose to an occasion when they had never expected to be the one to do that. Do you have some organizing tips from your books and some special people that you remember from the campaigns around the country?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And there are certain ways that this stuff works. It all comes down to the quality and caliber of the people that begin the work and basically whether those people are willing to work outside the system or not and not willing to acquiesce to the pressure that's inevitably put on them from the experts and the other people who say you can't do that or it's illegal or unconstitutional. And I think some of the heroes that stand out in my head are people like Fred Walls. He's a retired dairy farmer in central Pennsylvania who led a home rule campaign in his municipality of St. Thomas, a little township in south central Pennsylvania, against a gravel quarry that was next door, coming in next door. Kathy Miarelli, who was a school nurse, who was one of the people on the Tamaqua Borough Council who passed the first Rights of Nature ordinance in the United States. Who has now become active in the state community rights network stuff. Doug Shields, former president of the Pittsburgh City Council, who carried the water for the ban on oil and gas extraction within the city of Pittsburgh. John Olivas, who is the chairman of the Mora County Commissioners in New Mexico, which was the first county to adopt a rights-based ordinance that banned all hydrocarbon extraction within the county of Mora. And then there, you know, my favorite people, some of them are lawyers, like Ann Neeland in Oregon, who's leading the charge for ballot access for these initiatives in Oregon to ban, you know, pesticide spraying from the air, so aerial pesticide spraying, GMOs, self-government stuff, rights of nature. So there are all these heroes that have emerged from these different communities who are now to varying degrees out on the stump. You know, just recently, John Olivas visited Lafayette, Colorado, which is the place running this ordinance to legalize civil disobedience. And one of my other heroes in Lafayette is a woman named Marilee Mazza, a newly elected city councilwoman who's leading the charge for the passage of this local law that bans oil and gas extraction within the city. So, you know, it takes a village. But it also, more importantly, takes some bold, courageous people who are able and willing to walk out, color outside the lines, is how we sometimes explain it. Mm-hmm.
You remind me of, in Colorado, then, Longmont is active there, and their story is in the book also for callers that wish to know more. Again, the book is a premium for pledging to the station at 895-2233. Please go to your phone and help keep programs like this on the air and help keep KZYX in good health here.
Yeah, this is something Derek Jensen said about your book. You've probably seen this, Thomas. Tireless, brilliant, and courageous, Thomas Lindsley and all our other great people at CELDEV have long been my heroes. If democracy and the planet have any chance of survival, it is through the work of wonderful people such as these who both teach us and inspire us to action. And that's from Derek Jensen about We the People. And again, you can get that for a Bill of the Month Club at 707-895-2233. There's one more quote you have from one of the people in your book who was working at the Grant Township, I guess in Pennsylvania, Stacy Long, and she said, "It's a ton of work and it makes me crabby." But then she says, "I derive strength from my wonderful little community." And you know when she says that this is going to be like a huge part of her life that she looks back on as a struggle for the rights of nature. 895-2233. We just have a few minutes left, so maybe instead of going through some of the case studies, which you can find in the book, maybe let's talk about how you end it with what you call the call. What is the call? The call of the wild.
Yeah, the call is basically a call out to folks who have had the same dissatisfaction and frustration that we've had with the existing system, the conventional system, and a call out to other people to join us. To walk this path and begin to do some of this work. I will also say, as a plug for the book probably, but the book is a foundation, provided the foundation for the new movie that just came out about our work, which is called We the People 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put together by a group called Tree Media, which made The 11th Hour, which was Leonardo DiCaprio's film about climate change and global warming stuff and mm-hmm. environmental issues in general. And so the book itself was the foundation piece for that We the People movie, which is about telling the stories of some of the communities and people that whose stories are told within the book as well.
Yeah, I guess that's just now coming out and getting its first previews around the country right now, right?
Yeah, it's probably about 100 film festivals, and its formal release, the premiere, what they call it, is due in March. And it just went up on iTunes as something that people can access to watch it as an advance order kind of thing.
And I ordered my copies a few days ago.
Yeah.
They're on the way.
Don't forget to order the book, too. I mean, that's where you can have all this information literally at your fingertips. And we have to sign off now. We want to thank you so much, Thomas Lindsay. Steve, you want to give people a last goodbye here?
Well, I'll mention a few things. The campaign you just mentioned, this We the People 2.0, is one of the main links on the main website for CELDEF. So that's celdef.org, CELDF. And more information about the book, if you want to see a little more about it, is at their publications link at celdef.org. And then there's also a link there to the campaign. That's We the People 2.0. That's one of the links on the main page. That'll also take you to some information about the video, also the same name, We the People 2.0. So, Tom, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for that book.
And again, to listeners, 895-2233 to make a final pledge for the hour, and thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.